Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. You can find it in most homes and on planes and grocery stores, hospitals and parks, corner coffee shops and the library and more. But when Wi-Fi was invented, no one envisioned its popularity. No longer just for computers, devices from watches to refrigerators are able to connect to the wireless internet. And that has caused some overload. Joining us now to talk about the past and future of Wi-Fi is editor-in-chief for Backchannel.com, Stephen Levy. Welcome back to the show, Stephen.
Thanks, Ann.
So when Wi-Fi was first conceived, how did the inventors see it being used?
They pretty much saw it as, an open invitation for people to invent how it would be used. What happens is that Wi-Fi was, a piece of the spectrum, meaning the possible ways to send out radio signals that was unlicensed. Now, when you watch television or, you get your cell phone service, you're using licensed spectrum. A big company spends a lot of money for that piece of radio waves, and they own it exclusively. But Wi-Fi was designed to take advantage of stuff where anyone can participate in it. So it was used for all sorts of things, from, using microphones in Broadway plays and anything you could think of. And it really wasn't conceived of as the standard way that a lot of people would be using their telecommunications.
What role did Steve Jobs have in transforming how companies used Wi-Fi for their devices?
So it was only in use for a couple of years, only available for a couple of years, and people were figuring out that you could hook up things like laptops to it. When Steve Jobs in 1998 came up with his new portable laptop called the iBook, and he built it into the product there. If you bought a $99 little card that you would put in, under the battery, it would be able, your laptop would be able to get Wi-Fi. Before then, laptops just didn't come with Wi-Fi. You could spend a lot of money for one of those cards, but people didn't have the routers, the things in their homes that would get it. Mm-hmm. And Apple also sold, like a router, a thing called the AirPort. So you could actually use your laptops within your home without having those cables connected, those unwieldy cables. You can walk around with it. And I remember really clearly when he was about to introduce this, he invited me to Cupertino to take a look. And, he was demonstrating it and, like, literally dancing around the big conference table with one of the laptops streaming a trailer for a movie. And he had me do one and follow him around. And it was revelatory back then. People didn't do that back then. Starbucks didn't have Wi-Fi back then, and Steve really made it popular by putting it into a very popular product.
Right. I mean, he made it something sort of like clean drinking water. You kind of expect it now, right?
Well, people totally expect it now. And, as a matter of fact, Wi-Fi is becoming, the main way that people communicate with it. Even if you use a cell phone now, most cell phones will try to recognize a Wi-Fi network and use that to save you money and often get a better signal than the cellular technology that you pay so much money for every month to get access to.
What are some of the problems now faced? What kind of problems does this create?
So what happens is that now pretty much everyone has Wi-Fi in their homes. And the way they have it is they, spend money for this thing called a router. This is usually an ugly-looking thing with a couple of antennas sticking out. Mm-hmm. And you put it near where the input from your cable company or telephone company puts internet to your home, so you connect it directly to that wire. And then the farther you get from that piece of equipment, that router, the weaker signal you get. And most everyone has dead spots in their home where, you can't walk with your laptop, or if you're, using Wi-Fi on your phone, you can't go there. And increasingly, it's not just laptops and phones, but it's all sorts of devices. You have a device that streams television content, right? And if that's far away from your router, you're going to have buffering problems. You're going to have a spinning wheel instead of, you know, watching Carrie Matheson fight the terrorists. And, you know, you got your Amazon Echoes, right? And, you know, and Dots. So you're going to spread these personal assistants around the house. You might have Sonos speakers. You might have, as you said before, your refrigerator might have Wi-Fi. You might have little buttons to, you know, order detergent when you run out and dot them around your house. So, you know, a lot of people now, you know, have over a dozen of little gadgets in their home that use Wi-Fi, and as one router is, you know, being not only overused, but you know, the devices don't work that well if you're far away. So it was time for a different solution.
So what is the new trend in routers that they come in packs? Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, so the new Wi-Fi, as I call it, doesn't use just one router, and, you know, and what a lot of people had done was, you know, they bought some equally ugly device called an extender to put somewhere else in your house, and, you know, and that usually didn't pick up much of the signal, and often, you know, you would need a different name for the thing, so, you know, you'd be confused about your different networks in your home, which one was which. This one uses a pack of, you know, these little devices. Usually they're very well designed. They come in packs like wolves and mean girls. And you dot them around the house. You leave them around. And they work in one network. They have the same name and the same password. But as you move around the house, they pass off to each other. Just like when you're driving around the city, different cell towers will pass you on from one thing to another. So it's like a seamless way to get Wi-Fi spread throughout the house and, you know, and carry on pretty much the signal strength pretty much throughout the house there. It's a perfect solution, except you pay a lot more.
Right. And this gets rid of those dead zones as you move through your home, but does the load change as well so that you can be running all these different appliances on it?
Well, the speed for which it comes into the house is really up to the cable company or the telephone company, whoever you get, or the, you know, if you're lucky, mm-hmm. the fiber, which comes in there. Now, those speeds have been going up, but because of the failings of traditional Wi-Fi, the good old Wi-Fi, people haven't been able to get the advantage of those increased speeds. And sometimes people's routers in adjoining houses or apartments. I live in an apartment in New York City. There's about 30 of them I see when I, you know, click onto that little button on the screen. They interfere with it and make it slower. So what some of these things do, or they're smart enough to detect when someone else is competing on a similar channel, and they switch you over to something else.
How will these networks eliminate or mitigate some of the problems that traditional Wi-Fi routers have had then? They do it by passing things along. They're smart.
Right, yeah, they're smart. You know, they can tell interference. And they monitor the performance of the routers in each room. You name them, you say which room they are, and you can see which one is giving you Wi-Fi at a given moment. Sometimes some of them, you know, even let you do it remotely. Pretty much all these systems are controlled by an app. So whereas before it was a mystery what was happening, why things, you know, the wheel was spinning on your mm-hmm. Laptop. Now you can go to the app and check it out. You know, I remember I was testing one out and I was in California and my wife complained about, you know, what was going on, and I was able to check with my app to see what the problem was from 2,500 miles away. You know, go, just reconnect this one over there, and then the problem solved. It also creates sort of an obsession. Another good way to waste your time is to constantly monitor performance of your Wi-Fi network there, right? That was something that, you know, we didn't used to do, but now it's a good way to burn a few minutes.
Oh, my gosh. So, a couple of things you've brought up is these devices, when you create these packs, they cost money. You want faster speeds, that costs money. I feel like we're creating another haves and have not situation.
Well, in terms of the quality, you know, of you're going to get, it definitely is. I mean, the adoption curve is really tilting to the kind of people who like to spend money on gadgets. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, you know, had to learn originally, you know, gee, what's a router? That sounds like a funny name. It's not very descriptive. Everyone's laptop has Wi-Fi now, and you know, increasingly they're getting these other devices like Amazon Echoes that use the Wi-Fi. This is like another big leap. I compare it to really, the move from spending, $4 or $5 for a latte as opposed to the 50-cent cup of coffee. Because this stuff costs several hundred dollars. When you're done with it, some of them, cost $500 for a 3-pack. Some of them are a little less expensive, but they do it in a way where clearly they're appealing to a certain demographic. There was one company called Eero, which is named after a famous designer, the guy who designed the TWA terminal and the Gateway Arch, and those like chairs that are look like just like the bones of chairs, right?
Right.
Because I postulate that every product named after a designer immediately costs a little more. You have to pay a premium for that.
Right. They're not cheap, but we're hooking up more and more things to them. And I kind of wondered, as I was reading about this, to what extent houses will just become outfitted with them at the outset.
Well, I think that we're in a transitional period now. I think in a few years, we're going to have fewer things spread around the house that are just for Wi-Fi, but those radios are going to be put into other devices. There's one in particular I tested. It's different than the others. It's called Plume. That has a lot of the chips that most routers have missing there. That basically it does the computing that takes place in a router in the cloud. So these things are so small that they look like the not much bigger than the adapters that you do to change a 2-prong plug to a 3-prong plug. You plug into the socket there. You plug these into a socket, and what it shows you can make these radios that carry the signal really small. So I think we're going to see those dropping into other devices, whether it's our smoke alarms or thermostats or personal assistant things. So basically, I think people are going to have dozens of these like routers just built into stuff that's going to be around the house, and sort of the our whole existence is going to be going from one hot spot to another.
Stephen Levy, thanks for joining us today. I always appreciate your time.
Well, it's always fun, Anne. Thank you.
Stephen Levy, editor at backchannel.com. More Tech Tuesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg last week released a 600-word open letter outlining his vision for the social media giant, which now boasts nearly 2 billion users around the world. That sort of reach raises questions of power and influence. And after the notorious fake news of the recent election cycle, critics blamed Facebook for much of the problem. Zuckerberg dismissed the criticism last year. Now he appears to be changing his tune. Will Oremus last week analyzed Zuckerberg's manifesto for Slate. He joins us now. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
And listeners, would like to know what you think about the role Facebook plays in your life. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I have been corrected. I said 600-word. It was 6,000-word open letter. My mistake. The open letter, once again, 6,000 words. It was entitled Building Global Community. It's doubtful that most people read the whole thing. Will, can you sum up what he was shooting for here?
Yeah, I was going to correct you if you didn't correct yourself, Anne, because if it had been 600 words, then I wouldn't have needed to write a 1,000-word summary.
Right. I would have read it. Go ahead.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's verbose, and there's a lot of jargon. The word community appears a lot. There's a phrase that he uses 15 times, which is social infrastructure, which we can get into in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, through most of Facebook's history, it has had this famous mission statement of making the world more open and connected. Basically, Zuckerberg professed to believe in the power of sharing and of giving people a voice to make the world a better place. I think events of the past year or two and sort of widening global inequality and maybe just Zuckerberg growing up and becoming a little wiser have led him and many others within Facebook and without to think that maybe just giving people a voice isn't necessarily enough to make the world a better place. So what this manifesto signals is that Zuckerberg is trying to shift Facebook's focus from just letting people talk and hear each other to trying to build communities, whatever that means. And he doesn't do a great job of defining it, but there was an interview where he used the metaphor of a church. He wants people to be able to form bonds on Facebook. He wants it to sort of be a force to uphold institutions and social norms, a place where people feel comfortable. And that's a very different idea from the sort of more radical idea of just sort of letting everybody say what they want and be heard.
Yeah. Do you think he fully acknowledges what Facebook has become, just as much of a silo as every other media company in the world?
No, he doesn't. The acknowledgement is implicit, not explicit. So he doesn't come out and say, we regret that Facebook has become a force for spreading fake news and sensationalism around the world, which would be the truth, in my opinion. he doesn't say that. But it is implicit because he wouldn't be writing 6,000 words about Facebook's new direction if he didn't think there was something wrong with the direction that it had before.
So what new direction is he proposing? What would it look like to the average Facebook user?
Well, you know, one thing that Facebook has been moving toward that is reflected in this manifesto is the idea of trying to conform to the social and cultural norms of different cultures around the world. So, you know, one thing that they've struggled with is that what counts as hate speech in one country might count as free speech in another country. What looks to Facebook's artificial intelligence like child pornography might actually be a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo of a girl surviving a napalm attack in the Vietnam War. Mm. And so one of the things that he's thinking about here is how to make Facebook fit in with and uphold the norms of the societies in which it operates, rather than simply imposing Silicon Valley's view of the world on those places. So that's the global view. There's also a domestic angle here, and I think Zuckerberg would never and probably will never acknowledge that he regrets the role Facebook played in the 2016 presidential election. His official stance is that the people who came out in that election and circulated fake news, or the people who circulated sensational stories, they were being heard in a way that might not have been possible without Facebook. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, Facebook does, it is in Silicon Valley. It's a liberal place. His employees, a lot of them are very anti-Donald Trump, and a lot of them were appalled to think that Facebook helped to play a role in further polarizing the electorate by just telling people what they want to hear. I think this is somewhat of an acknowledgement of that, maybe not just on the conservative side, but on the liberal side as well, that Facebook has really become a force for people to get further polarized within their own ideological communities and to stop talking across those ideological lines with each other. I think Zuckerberg recognizes that, and he wants to see what could be done to make Facebook a place where we can get back to having some common discourse between conservatives and liberals, between other cultural factions, rather than just staying in our own little silos.
So you think his motivation then was spurred by the people who he works with and who work for him, who were troubled by what most people agree was this new role?
Yeah, I honestly think that's part of it. And, you know, I could be wrong, but there have been a lot of reports that Facebook employees were holding meetings and organizing groups because mm-hmm. they were very upset by the role Facebook had played. I probably should say this explicitly, but Facebook was the dominant platform through which the phenomenon of fake news arose. It was a place where stories that had no basis in reality could be circulated and could get millions of views and actually be read by more people than true news stories about the election. So that's troubling. And then also just the fact that Facebook has created this media environment, which we've talked about before, where the most sensational, the most incredible headline is the one that gets circulated and not the one that sort of accurately describes the news. So I do think that employees' disgust with that has played a role there. Recruiting is incredibly important to tech companies like Facebook. I mean, if they can't get the sort of best and brightest young programmers, then they're headed for a long, slow decline into irrelevance.
Right, because if those people think that they're contributing to a big problem, they won't go there.
Exactly. It's what they call in Silicon Valley a mission-driven company, and they recruit based on the idea that they're making the world a better place. Whether that's true or not mm-hmm. is in the eye of the beholder, but a lot of the people who work there buy into it, and if they stop buying into that, then they're going to look elsewhere because those programmers have extraordinary value on the open market. They can go wherever they want.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with tech writer Will Oremus. He recently wrote a piece for Slate. We'll post a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. In it, Will analyzes this 6,000-word manifesto by Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, posted last week. It was entitled Building Global Community. You made note of his repeated use of the phrase social infrastructure to describe Facebook. What do you make of that, besides how vague it is?
Yeah, so this term social infrastructure, he leans on it again and again. And to me, that's a way of, if you read between the lines, that's a way of getting around a binary argument that has been circulating around Facebook for the past couple of years, which is the question of, is it a tech company or is it a media company?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it started as a tech company in the sense that it's a platform, it's a technological tool through which people can express themselves, and Facebook didn't originally take much of a role in deciding what gets expressed. Now, over the years, it has evolved from a social network where people connect with each other into a dominant source of news. So people go on Facebook to read the news, and in that capacity, Facebook's algorithm, which decides, you know, what you see in your feed when you open up the app, Facebook's algorithm has taken on extraordinary power in shaping what news people read, and it has actually had seismic impacts on the news industry and on the media in general. And so for that reason, Facebook has been compelled to think a little bit more seriously about, well, if our algorithm is determining what news people read, do we need to, you know, think a little more carefully about whether that is good, you know, whether the algorithm's effects are good for society, whether they create an informed citizenry, or whether they're just polarizing everybody and making everybody angry at the other side.
I wonder why he denies that Facebook is a media company, given the use of its algorithms to orient news. Newspapers do it every day. You know, they tell you what's on the front page, and that's the front page. They do it differently, though, because it's different for everybody.
Yeah, I think there are a couple reasons for that. I mean, the first one, the most simple surface level explanation is that in Facebook's mind and in Zuckerberg's mind, a media company is a company that creates content. And Facebook is not primarily in the business of creating content. They are a platform on which other people share content that they've created. That said, media companies are also about curating content. They're about deciding which content people see. Facebook most certainly does that. But they don't want to take on the responsibilities that media companies have for, you know, having sort of human editors decide what's important in the day's news and what isn't, because, you know, I think one simple reason is that everybody hates the media. When you have editors whose job is to decide what people see, what news people see and what news people don't see, inevitably they are going to be hated by people who disagree with those decisions. You look at, you know, we have a media environment right now where a large majority of conservatives trust Fox News as their news source and think that, and a lot of them think CNN is, you know, fake news or trash or sensationalism. You go on the liberal side and a lot of people trust CNN or MSNBC. They think Fox News is junk or fake news or sensationalism. And so you end up with no media company that everybody likes. Well, Facebook, its business is built on its ability to reach everybody, to reach across partisan lines. If it stops being the place where both conservatives and liberals connect with each other, then it loses a lot of its value. So it has to walk a really delicate line there to avoid being seen as partisan in any way. And refusing to acknowledge its role in the media is, I think, is central to that strategy.
Zuckerberg emphasized five attributes for this global community that he hopes to build: a supportive, safe, informed, civically engaged, and inclusive. You know, sounds like utopia to me. What's he getting at there?
Yeah, it's hard to be, I mean, it's hard to be against any of these things, which is partly why a lot of people find fault with this manifesto for being sort of vague. You could even say that it's pablum of a sort. I mean, it's saying a lot of nice things that don't really mean a whole lot when you drill down into it. I think to the extent that it means anything, and I think it does mean something, I think it means that Facebook is starting to commit itself to being more than just a technological platform. It's starting to, it doesn't want to be called a media company still, but this term social infrastructure, as opposed to just infrastructure or a tech platform or an internet company, that signals that they are interested in something more than just being a technological tool. And I think it also signals that they're going to be willing to take a little bit more of an active or interventionist role in the effect that the Facebook algorithm has on communities. So if they find that that Facebook is lending itself to people feeling unsafe, then they're not going to take an absolutist stand in favor of free speech. They're going to find ways to downgrade the type of speech that's making people feel unsafe and promote the kind of speech that makes people feel safe. So I think they really are committing themselves to a couple of real objectives here. It's just that they're not very good. This manifesto is not very good at acknowledging what the trade-offs are. It sort of pretends that you can have it all, and of course you can't, because one person's post that promotes civic engagement is another person's post that makes them feel unsafe, right? I mean, there are all kinds of posts you can imagine about the Trump's executive order on immigration and refugees, where some people would say, oh, this is making me feel unsafe, and other people are saying, well, I'm posting this as in order to be civically engaged. I think the manifesto doesn't really reckon with what are the real trade-offs there, and how do you deal with the conflicts that are going to inevitably arise between these values that everybody agrees are good things in the abstract.
All right. I mean, Facebook's been criticized for allowing people to live in a bubble. You know, that silo I talked about earlier, only see what they agree with. What about, I mean, what role can their algorithm play in changing that? Or just get rid of it?
Just get rid of Facebook?
Get rid of the algorithm.
Yeah. I mean, so the algorithm's really what Facebook's value is built on.
Right.
It's the reason, in my opinion, that Facebook is doing so well, and Twitter, for example, is doing so poorly. In Twitter, you have to follow people manually, and you see everything they post, and so your whole feed is full of, you know, just as much mundane stuff or stuff you don't want to see as it is full of stuff that's relevant to you. Facebook's algorithm has done an incredible job of, when you open the Facebook app, you're going to see the stuff from the friends and family members that you interact with the most. You're going to see the news that conforms to the type of news you want to read. And the big question, the really deeper existential question for Facebook here is, can they do that? Can their algorithm give people what they want without also making the world a worse place, to invert the cliche about making the world a better place, further insulating people in these bubbles and insulating them from any views that would challenge their preconceptions?
Now, we just talked last week about a new Pew Research study that reported that many people can't even recall the source of news when they find it on social media. They just say, well, it's Facebook. It's Facebook. I found it on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. Did he address that issue. This is a real thing. They don't know that they've just read a New York Times or a BuzzFeed article. They are equating it because it's all on Facebook.
Yeah, and that, in my opinion, is one of the core problems here. In an era where people trusted the media more, I think part of that was because you got your news by subscribing to a newspaper or by watching the same local news anchors every night or the same national news anchors every weekend, and you would grow to trust those voices over time. If you didn't trust them, then you would drop your subscription and subscribe to somebody else that you do trust. But in all cases, you would know the source of your information and you would know something about that source. Facebook has really stripped that away by becoming the intermediary and the sort of clearinghouse where news is distributed. Facebook just strips away the context that you need to evaluate the source. So you see the headline, and then in small print you see the name of the source, but it's really hard to tell the difference between a trustworthy source and a source that might be making stuff up or that might be that might be pandering to your political views without a lot of regard to the facts. I think that's a big problem. Facebook has not come out and explicitly addressed that. They do have a couple minor programs that could help. They have this thing called Instant Articles, where a few prestigious publications can now publish articles directly on the Facebook platform. The algorithm is designed to boost those posts, and so outlets like the New York Times or National Geographic are able to reach readers on Facebook in a way that a fake news outlet would not be able to reach them. So if stuff like that becomes more popular, and I think it may, then Facebook might try to correct course a little bit and be able to give people a little bit of a better sense of who they're reading and who they're seeing rather than just the headline.
And something that I think Mark Zuckerberg is sort of thinks he's shooting for but is missing by a mile, and it's not necessarily anybody's fault, is that when you talk about how we all kind of read the morning paper or the afternoon paper back in the, ancient, when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, and then also how we used to sit down together and watch the evening news, we all watched the same thing at the same time together.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are. I don't want to romanticize the old days of media because there were a lot of downsides as well to the fact that you had these very few, generally large corporate gatekeepers that decided what everybody saw every night and what everybody didn't see. There were a lot of views that went unheard in those times, and maybe there was sort of a lot of false consensus around a status quo that didn't necessarily deserve it. But it's absolutely true that the splintering of media into thousands of different outlets, most of which you've probably never heard of or seen before, has contributed to this world we live in now, where people not only have their own opinions, but everybody has their own facts, and people can't agree on sort of the basic facts needed to achieve a political consensus. That's not just Facebook. I think it started with cable. When the major networks were no longer the only way to get TV. It continued with the internet and with Google, and Facebook is just the latest way in which that consensus has been, or that sort of shared information has been eroded and splintered, so that everybody gets their own stuff to confirm their own views.
And what else is Facebook involved in too that expands its mission beyond this social infrastructure that Mark Zuckerberg likes to refer to?
Yeah, and so when he talks about social infrastructure, it is a convenient term because it is so vague, but it allows Facebook to include some of its other projects in there. So they own Oculus, the virtual reality company, which makes those really dorky looking virtual reality headsets. But they see that as eventually a way that people will connect with each other. You could be in your living room in Columbus, but you could be virtually. You could be in Beijing or at a Knicks game in Madison Square Garden. Or in Tahrir Square during the protests. So that's a form of social infrastructure in his mind, at least down the road. Mm-hmm. They also own WhatsApp, which is the very popular messaging app. That service has filled a very different role from Facebook for sort of one-to-one and small group communication. So social infrastructure allows it to encompass those things as well. But it just doesn't really provide any clearer of a picture of what Facebook itself really is about.
Will Arimus, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Good talking with you as always.
Will Arimus is a tech writer for Slate. We'll have a link to his article about Mark Zuckerberg's open letter, Building Global Community, on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The messaging app Snapchat is one of the most popular social apps available, more than 150 million active users. That's good news for the parent company, now called Snap, as they prepare for their initial public offering in the coming weeks. And Snap is creating more buzz this week by making their Snap Spectacles available for online sale. Joining us now to discuss that and other tech news, contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, all right, I'm so out of it, but I didn't even know there was such a thing as Snap Spectacles. They release these things in pop-up locations in November, probably around a lot of college campuses, I would imagine, or I don't know what. What were they shooting for? What are they?
Yeah, they were all over the place, and then they were these weird little vending machines that would show up for a couple of hours and then disappear, and they had these great big balloons that were attached to them to try and get people's attention, and it worked. There were lines for just forever, just massive, massive lines of people anytime one of these vending machines showed up to try and get a hold of these. And they're sunglasses with a little camera built into the sunglasses to transfer video and photos to your phone that you could then share on Snapchat.
And they're all different colors and they're really groovy looking and that kind of a thing. How do the videos get from the glasses to your phone and onto a Snapchat app?
It's a Bluetooth connection. So the battery inside of the glasses powers the camera and a Bluetooth connection so that the app on your phone can browse for files that are, stored on the glasses, and you can pull them and edit them just like you would any other photo or video that you would record, to post on Snapchat. So if you wanted to, create a Snapchat story from multiple, videos and photos that you had taken, then you could do so, from the app, just using this camera as basically a separate source.
And by the way, it's not like getting a candy bar out of a vending machine. These things come... They cost about $130 right now. At the outset, was it more of a publicity stunt? What do you make about this the arc of this particular story?
Yeah, this was a big publicity stunt, and it was one of several things that Snapchat did that were a little on the unusual side to get people's attention. Another big thing that we saw when they first made the announcement was those trays when you go into airport security, you put all your stuff into a tray. Push it through. Well, they had ads for the spectacles in the bottoms of all of those trays. So during, basically the months of, December and January, if you traveled through a lot of different airports, there were these ads inside of the security trays, which is really bizarre. I had never seen that before.
Yeah, I never have seen that before either. That is, gosh, I'm telling you. They're pretty simple compared to something like Google Glass. They look like strange colored sunglasses. Do you think that that'll help with their acceptance, that they're not really complicated looking?
I think that they're not being complicated looking, doesn't help a ton, because the concern that a lot of people had wasn't so much that they looked awkward. I mean, there were people concerned that Google Glass looked awkward, but the security concern there was that, when someone was taking a picture, it wasn't obvious. There wasn't someone holding their hand out or something like that. It was just reaching up and touching glasses. And Snapchat tried to work around that by including a small light in the left-hand side of the glasses so that, this ring of light shows up when someone goes to take a picture. So it's obvious to someone looking directly at the glasses, when a photo or a video is happening. But even then, it's still not very obvious, and there's no obvious, sound or anything like that. And you could very easily turn on the camera and then, walk around a corner or something like that and record something. So, The securities concern is still there, but this approaches a significantly younger demographic, and it approaches a much lower price tag than Google Glass. So
yeah.
It's you know, approaching a group that isn't as concerned with personal security as maybe they should be.
Yeah, and the people who are concerned with it wouldn't buy it. So,
right.
Yeah. Google has started to roll out a new feature on Android phones called Instant Apps. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Instant Apps, this is an extension of Google Chrome, the browser, and there are a lot of different things that you know people search the web for, and the results are more easily displayed inside of an app. You know, if you're looking for showtimes to a movie or restaurants that are in your area or something like that, it's common to search for those things on Google. But the results, as you see them in the Google browser, aren't always the best way to show them. So Instant Apps take the app display, you know, the way that you would see information in an app, and presents it in the Chrome browser, you know, through basically the app for maybe Yelp or you know a StubHub or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in effect, the app itself is running through Chrome on your phone without actually needing to be installed.
Yeah, does it so it's not actually installed, only as long as you're looking at it.
Yeah, right. It's available in that format through that app, as long as you're looking at it. And you can choose from that point to go ahead and install the app on your phone if you decide that information was valuable and you wanted to do something more than that one use. Or you can close the Chrome tab that you have open and the app just completely goes away. It hasn't taken up any space on your phone and you haven't given it any personal data.
I kind of like that idea, but I'm afraid that I might accidentally give it data. I might accidentally sign up.
You know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's going to be up to the individual app developer, you know, and this, you know, this is a conversation that we kind of had amongst ourselves here was, you know, this is really great for, you know, probably the really big name apps, like I said before, Yelp and StubHub and things like that, where there's an immediate downside to being kind of shady with how they present, you know,
yeah,
the ability to install. And so I think that's why Google is handling this very slowly right now. This is not something that every app developer can just go and do through Chrome right now. There's a list of developers that are working with Google right now, and they're all kind of trusted developers that you know have an active interest in not being, you know, shady when it comes to that kind of thing. So it'll be interesting to see how this grows from here and whether that becomes, you know, an active concern that, you know, you have this kind of app that is, you know, potentially doing something not great with your data, you know, in a way that you're not even actually aware of it, where it almost looks like a pop-up ad.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like Google is working really hard to actively avoid that.
And make it something like, hey, look, there's an app for that.
Right.
Yeah. When are Android users going to start to see this on their phones?
This is something that started rolling out this week. It'll be, you know, more available over the next couple of weeks. And Google is trying really hard to make it fit in, you know, very specific purposeful categories for right now. So it's only going to happen, you know, in very specific search terms like, you know, show me movies that are in this area.
Yeah.
And you'll, you know, you'll have that new kind of experience on your phone.
Okay. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest right now, of course, is Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Dell is releasing the latest version of its XPS 15 laptop. Who needs this, this kind of a laptop?
Well, this ends up being a really great, you know, kind of all-around laptop. It's great for students. It's great for teachers. It's great for, you know, people who just want an entertainment laptop. It's not a hardcore gaming machine by any stretch, but you know, it's a very capable machine. It's something that, you know, would end up lasting quite a while.
It's offering a $25 optional fingerprint reader. Is this... You're not big on the fingerprints, right?
I'm not a big fan of fingerprints. I think that on a social level, we are in the wrong direction for using fingerprint scanners as passwords. But it is something that exists, and it's something that has been a feature for laptops longer than it has been a feature for phones. And there are just, you know, some you know, it's usually companies, you know, that really just kind of appreciate having the feature around.
People will be able to choose between a full high definition or 4K monitor for the laptop. What are the pros and cons? Is it going to be a lot difference in expense?
There's going to be a couple $100 difference in price, but the biggest difference that you're going to see, you know, obviously there's going to be a visual difference where things are going to look very different on the screen. You're going to have more space to work with and, you know, kind of denser colors and things like that. But it's also going to be a larger battery drain. You know, drawing on that larger screen means that your battery life is going to be less than what you would normally expect.
Right. So, I mean, is there going to be a battery choice or is it just one kind of battery and...
It's just the one kind of battery. You know, a lot of these smaller laptops, especially over the last couple of years, you know, they're all field batteries, so they're not even removable.
Right.
So it's all, you know, kind of one container.
Okay. And the colleague of yours that wrote about this laptop had some complaints about the wireless card that comes installed. What were his concerns?
So this is using a different brand from what had been used previously. Dell had made their own wireless card for this previously, and this new version, I think for size reasons, it ended up just being a smaller physical card inside the computer, went with this from a company called Killer. And, yeah, there were just some performance differences, you know, where it wasn't quite as fast in certain places where the previous version had been.
And tell us about the cost and who you see in being its biggest competitor.
Really, this is a huge competitor for the Apple's MacBook Pro line. You know, one of the biggest complaints from Apple's MacBook Pro line for this year, Apple didn't really focus on a significant hardware increase, you know, a more capable processor or you know, more graphics capabilities, even the ability to run, you know, virtual reality devices or anything like that. And this laptop does all of those things. You know, it handles VR very well, and it's, you know, way smaller than you would expect from a laptop that would, you know, offer something like that. And Dell's whole focus right now with this display is to you know, make it look like there's basically no edge around the display, so the laptop looks a lot bigger than what you would think it is. And really, they started around $1,000, which is you know, within the same price range of what you would get a starting MacBook for.
Right. We have a quick call from Bob about batteries. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Russell, sir, what are we going to do about batteries? Has anybody got something new of you know, beyond lithium? Is there something new coming out? And have they solved the problems with lithium?
Russell?
Well, I don't know that they've solved any problems with lithium, but they're certainly, you know, have more steps in place to try to avoid problems, you know, from becoming significant over time. But really, the biggest thing that's happening with batteries right now is trying to make the, you know, the actual battery material more dense so that you have, you know, more battery capacity in a smaller space. And that's not always what, you know, people with phones and laptops want to hear. They want to hear batteries that last significantly longer.
Right.
And really, you know, all of the research being done in that space, you know, the thing that we hear is that, you know, using it in a practical environment is still a couple of years away. So I think what we have right now is pretty close to the experience we're going to get for, at the very least, the remainder of this decade.
You know, just real quick, you recently wrote about how to get Amazon's Alexa digital assistant in your home without buying an Echo. How do you do that?
Yeah, so there's actually, you know, Amazon worked with a bunch of different partners. They're fairly open about who they work with that, you know, will put the Alexa service on different hardware. And I actually found that there's a surprising number of different options that you have. One was even something that you could wear on your jacket. And it actually, it serves more purpose than just being available for Amazon Echo, and then a lot of the other accessories are, but that's, you know, kind of like one of their big primary selling points is it does, you know, these other things, but it is also exactly the same as the Amazon Echo as far as how it, you know, will speak to you.
Wow. Okay. So maybe more on that down the road, but in the meantime, Russell Holly, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
As always, Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Coming up next week, there'll be more to talk about. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Sarah Stacy, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening, as always. And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.